Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Night 2 of the 2018 Clare House Community Conversation Series will take place tomorrow evening at the Hard Rock Hotel in Catoosa. The event will feature Dr. Jessica Zitter, a critical and palliative care specialist and author. She's featured in the Academy Award-nominated short documentary called Extremis, which will be shown, followed by a presentation and book signing of her fine book from 2017 called Extreme Measures. Zitter works at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California, where at certain points her job is to provide critical care to the sickest patients in the hospital, and at other points she acts as a consultant on how to mitigate suffering and or ease the dying process, which should seem like two sides of the same role, but for which she's unique in having formally trained in both specialties. I interviewed Dr. Zitter in 2017 when her book came out, so today we're going to rebroadcast it in light of her upcoming appearance at the Hard Rock. If you'd like more information or to RSVP for the event, just call 918-893-6150. Dr. Jessica Zitter is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Jessica Nudick-Zitter, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start by congratulating you on the book because I think it's really marvelous. Explain to us what you mean by the metaphor of the end-of-life conveyor belt. It's kind of a haunting image. What do you mean by that?
Well, the end-of-life conveyor belt is really something that pertains only to a particular group of patients coming into the ICU. It pertains to those with really serious illness or essentially who are dying. It's for those patients the sort of relentless, protocolized, automatic use of an increasing sort of level of technology to prop up their organs as they begin to fail. And, you know, for these patients, then again, who are dying and whose underlying disease isn't going to improve from our interventions, they just become sort of what I would call encased in these technologies and machines until they die.
Let's be specific about what those technologies are because, you know, you especially have worked in that field. You're trained in critical care. And one of the great aspects of your book is it's a memoir, really, but it also has some elements, I would say, of a how-to or self-help in terms of helping the reader think and visualize how it is we want to die or how to experience our own death, which is something, of course, most of us don't really ever want to talk about or think about, but it behooves us to do so. So mechanical ventilators, let's start there. What is that?
A mechanical ventilator is a machine that essentially puffs air out at a predetermined setting. So when a person cannot breathe on their own or on his own, this machine can be connected to a tube which then descends into the patient's large airways, and a compressor will essentially compress the right amount of air into the person's lungs to inflate them. And in the beginning, when it's first, you know, started, it's done through a temporary tube that goes in through the mouth, sometimes through the nose, and then goes into the trachea, which is the main airway. But after a period of time, if the patient is not getting better or getting strong enough to breathe on his or her own, then we have to transfer that tube into a more permanent connection that's surgical through the neck, and that's called a tracheostomy. And that is a sort of more secure connection. It's less likely to get pulled out. And it also, you know, allows for the mouth to be cleaned. And in some cases, people can even maybe eat something. But, you know, ultimately for many, especially those who are very debilitated and weak, it really just serves to be a permanent anchor to machines until they die. So that's the mechanical ventilator.
So why is it so hard for people to stop the mechanical ventilator? If medically you can't come off of it, it becomes really an ethical thing. And I think for patients and families, it becomes, you know, a feeling where I think it feels like we're killing our loved one. That came across to me, especially in the documentary, in Extremis, this film that you're featured in.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you really think about it, what are some of the processes that we do that are probably most critical to our psyche? And breathing, I would say, is one of them. I mean, the idea of, you know, not being able to breathe and feeling short of breath and, you know, starve for oxygen is a really quite a terrifying feeling. And I think that it's also a physiologic process that, you know, if it stops being supported, a lot of times patients can die rather quickly. You know, in the case of Donna in Extremis, it took her a day to die, which for some people it might take you know, who don't have adequate strength to breathe, it might take several days, maybe a few weeks. It could happen even in that moment that you take the tube out if it's a really serious case of respiratory failure. But I think there's just something that feels very direct about removing something and having somebody die, particularly if there is any respiratory distress. And so I think it's just a very basic drive to breathe, and I think it's very scary for people, whether they're doctors, whether they're family members, to say, okay, take it out, and I understand that this person's going to die. I think there's a similar type of response to feeding. You know, a lot of times when patients really are dying, it's of more burden to their bodies to continue to feed them through feeding tubes or certainly even by mouth, and they may clearly not want more food. And yet we feel, you know, this sense of, well, you know, eating is such a human experience. It's such a, the idea of starving is so goes against our human drive that I think it's another one of those examples of things where people just really have a hard time saying, you know what, we understand this isn't really helping, and this is not the way this person would want to live, and we're going to stop it. They're very primal human drives.
One of the things in the book that was so powerful was the example you gave of a devoted family member feeding a patient who was in extremis, who was actively dying. You made the leap or realization for us, the readers, that that family member was really feeding himself, in a sense. By feeding his loved one, it was making him feel better, or it was making the medical team feel better, but it really wasn't helping the patient.
Yeah. And, you know, in a way, how could this person have possibly known that? Because for most of life, you know, giving a little bit of chicken broth or something like that really is a nurturing act, and it usually isn't going to hurt somebody. But in this case, when someone's really close to the end, it can actually cause worse problems, which it did in that particular case. And it's not something that you would expect most people to know, because, again, this is really a unique time in life, which is right towards the end, and people don't necessarily know this about food. And I think this is a big piece of education that we need to get out there to people, that when someone is actively dying and they are not asking or reaching or accepting eagerly food, it may be time to slow down on the food or stop it altogether.
You write in the book, you start the book by saying you never set out to be an evangelist. Do you see yourself as an evangelist for stopping people or getting people off of the end-of-life conveyor belt?
What I see myself as an evangelist for doing is really educating people so that they can make those decisions themselves. Because in my travels and having gone through, you know, caring for so many different kinds of people, I've seen that it's really personal how people want to die. And I really want to honor anyone's choice for how they want to die. There are so many different priorities and values. What's most important to me is that people have the information that they need in order to figure out what that will mean for them. And those are what I would consider the best deaths. So that's the evangelism that I espouse, which is really let everybody drive the car, or at least have people who know them really well be driving the car with a full set of radar and and information about where they're driving to.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jessica Nudick-Zitter. She's the author of the fabulous new book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. She's also featured in a documentary called Extremis that is viewable on the Netflix streaming service, and I would encourage you to watch that. It's less than 30 minutes. It's an Oscar-nominated short. But that movie is very powerful and really, I think, brings to life many of the themes that you touch on in this book. Dr. Zitter, there's something I want to, a moment in the book I want to ask you about. You have spent years and years, first of all, the first part of the book is just so wonderful and evocative, where you talk about your childhood in Montreal, where you come from a family of physicians, I think particularly a line of surgeons, mostly males, I think, or almost all males.
Mm-hmm.
And you, as the female descendant in that line, wind up going into not surgery, where you, I think, made the realization that you didn't want to live your life that way, but into something very procedurally intensive, which is intensive care, and you do the residency and followed by the pulmonary and critical care fellowship, so a total of at least 6 years there. And then as a young attending at a hospital in New Jersey, you are putting a dialysis catheter in a patient who's very elderly, who needs that catheter in order to get dialyzed or else she'll die from kidney failure. When a nurse named Pat comes to you, you're sterilely gowned and gloved, about to put in this
dialysis catheter in her neck, sort of an invasive procedure. And Pat says out loud for everyone to hear, I'm going to call 911 because the doctor is assaulting this patient, or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Tell us about that moment. What was going on, and how did it affect you?
That is my really, I would say, my moment of, you could call it epiphany, but I'd actually call it like release in a way. Because I had been, for years really, I'd been practicing. I'd been in medical school residency for, an early career for 10 years before that moment. And I had had really a number of moments, and in fact, I'd say daily, where I felt like, ooh, I don't know that what I'm doing here is really going to help this person, but this is what I'm supposed to do. This is the next step on my protocol. And, usually this is around a patient who's very seriously ill or dying, but they were treated just the same as the patients who really were more young and robust and able to really, to ultimately potentially get better. So I'd always had these feelings of, but they were subtle. I had sort of suppressed them because I had to, I had no other options. I didn't really know any other way of doing this. This is all that I had been taught, was how to continue along my protocols. I mean, I was kind and I cared about my patients, but I still, when it came down to treating them, medically, all I knew was what the next physiologically appropriate step would be. And so when Pat, the interesting part about the story is that I had just started working at this hospital, UMDNJ, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, which is now called New Jersey Medical School. And by a stroke of like Forrest Gump-like luck, I happened to be at this hospital in Newark, which was one of four recipients of many applications. I believe there were 422 applications for this grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to enhance communication in the intensive care unit. This was 2002, I believe, before, years before palliative care would become an official subspecialty. And so there was this team that was led by Pat, who was trained in principles of palliative care. And also she worked with Ann Mosenthal, who's a trauma surgeon at UMDNJ. And the two of them had won this grant. And again, very rare, very unique. And so there was this family, quote-unquote family support team, which was really the precursor to the palliative care team at UMDNJ. And they would come into the ICU with this grant, and they had sort of carte blanche to come in and talk to my patients, which is really something that was unheard of, I would say, in those days. People didn't talk to your patients about anything substantial. They were your patients, and it was your role as the doctor to make every decision and determination.
And I should just hasten to add, people didn't come talk to your patients without your permission. You would ask for a consultation, perhaps, from a specialist, but this was highly unusual.
Exactly, exactly. This was Pat and her group were, first of all, they were not doctors. And so there's this, very hierarchical structure in medicine where, which I hope is going to change, where nurses really didn't have much input into the plan, and particularly in those days, and they didn't necessarily come in and talk about anything that wasn't sort of passed by the physician, the attending first. So here's Pat and her group talking to my patients about their prognosis and about making sure they understood what was going on. And I thought, who are these people? And I was frankly frustrated and kind of felt that it was risky, and what if they upset my patient? And that day, so this had been going on for a month or so, and I would sort of feel a little quizzical and a little, frankly, irritated. And then when this happened, it was the first moment where just all of my irritation with this group just melted, and all of these feelings I'd had for years about, oof, what am I doing, that were kind of shoved away, all of a sudden just bounced up at me, and I thought, oh my gosh, she's right. I'm not going to help this patient with this catheter. This doesn't feel like the right thing to do, but I couldn't figure out a way out of it because the dialysis nurse was standing outside with a dialysis machine waiting, tapping her foot. They were, waiting to do this. The team was waiting for our report. The husband was sitting and waiting anxiously for me to help his wife by putting this catheter in the waiting room. My medical student was sitting next to me, excited to see this procedure. I did not know how to do anything different. And so I'm ashamed to say that I did put the catheter in, but, really, it didn't help that patient, but it definitely started my journey towards a new way of practicing medicine.
It was such a powerful scene in the book, and it just shows the strong power of inertia and this conveyor belt mentality, which is, you said you'd had the best training, you'd been to wonderful universities and one of the best residency programs and fellowship programs in the entire country, and you'd been trained in what to do, but never really been trained, in all honesty, about what not to do or how to talk about when it was maybe not appropriate to do some of these things.
Yeah.
And so we've definitely reached a moment, I think, in medicine, and I read more and more about this concept of less is more. And I see it even in the primary care world where I work, where sometimes we're overzealous in our application of screening tests. But in your world, critical care and palliative care, we're trained. I mean, it's just almost reflex at this point that more is better. More treatment usually means more survival, and we think more life. But so give us an example, if you will, of where this assertion is kind of turned on its head.
There is a lot of data in the palliative care literature that actually, you know, shows that patients who receive, you know, palliative care consultations, first of all, choose to use a much lower level of technologic intensity in their treatment. They spend fewer days in the intensive care unit. They spend fewer days on breathing machines. They spend more days at home. They certainly spend less time uncomfortable and in pain and suffering, as reported by their surrogates. And there is plenty of data also to show that there's really no decrease in life lived in terms of duration. So, you know, this concept that hospice and palliative care are somehow going to come and hasten death, or, you know, in patients with serious illness who are already dying, is actually not true. In some cases, and there have been many studies in a variety of different types of cancers that have actually looked at numbers of patients who have appeared to do better, who have appeared to live longer with metastatic lung cancer, metastatic colon cancer, with the support of hospice and palliative care. So, you know, I think that there's just many types of situations where we do things. I would call it almost like there's this concept called the technological imperative, which I actually looked up because it was coined, and I think it first came into use in the 1940s by a couple of different philosophers, sort of talking about the atom bomb. That, you know, this concern that we had this bomb, and that because it existed, that this technological imperative, you know, predicted that we were going to use it. And I think, you know, we celebrate technology in this country and in many countries, in both the developing and the developed world, that we believe that if we have it, we must use it, and we certainly should use it. And I think that is actually just not true.
I want to ask you about one specific technology that you sort of lived through, or at least the end of its cycle. It was invented, I think, in the early 1970s. It's called the Swan or Swan-Ganz catheter. And this was a catheter that's placed usually in the neck, and it has a small balloon at the tip that gets floated into the heart of the patient. And the reason that we use it is to measure central pressures, that is the pressure in the pulmonary artery, the heart, the ventricle, the atrium. And this became dogma. This was something that was absolutely used probably as much as possible in intensive care settings, even through my training. Although you and I went to the same medical school, I found out, and were taught by the same physician, Dr. Alfred Connors, who did an incredible study. And Dr. Connors had probably put in hundreds of Swan catheters over his career.
Probably thousands.
Thousands. And he started to wonder, do they make a difference?
Yeah.
And what he found was shocking, that not only did they not make a difference, in fact, they hastened death. They caused more suffering and more death.
Mm-hmm.
And he was vilified because, can you tell a little bit more about that story?
Again, as I was writing this book, I couldn't believe the weird coincidences that had happened in my life. But I, you know, Al Connor, who was a fantastic guy, who's now the head of Metro Health in Cleveland, was the person who taught me how to put in Swan-Ganz catheters in my sub internship at Case Western in the intensive care unit. And while I was working with him, unbeknownst to me, he had been participating in this study, the SUPPORT trial, which is a groundbreaking trial that came out in 1996, the results of which really shocked the medical community beyond belief, that showed this profound mechanized state of death and dying in this country. You know, just the large amounts of people dying on machines, the pain, the suffering, the poor, poor communication. And that was really, I think, to my knowledge, the first major study that showed this. And Al Connors had made Case Western or Metro one of the five SUPPORT trial centers, and because he really believed in this topic. And so while he was teaching me how to put in the swans and do all of the types of ICU treatment that I was doing, he was collecting data for the study. When the study came out in 1996, I was long gone from CASE. I was now starting my pulmonary and critical care fellowship, putting swans in left and right. We were putting in, you know, the numbers are astounding. 20 to 40% of all ICU admissions received a swan. We were spending $2 billion a year on swans at the height of it. And at that time, you know, the support trial came out showing this very mechanized state of death and dying. And Al Connors then did another paper looking at a subgroup analysis from this huge data set of dying patients to see what was going on with the swan. Was it helping? Was it not? And he found what you reported, which is this, you know, increase in death, that it was actually not helping and it was actually hurting. And when I called him to find out about it, he described, I said, I can't believe that not only were you part of one groundbreaking study that really talked about how we deal with patients in the intensive care unit, you know, the support trial, but then on top of it, you authored the second subgroup, you know, the sub-analysis of that data, of those data, and debunked the SWAN. And, you know, here are two institutions that are near and dear to your heart, you know, the SWAN and the ICU, you're coming up with this huge critique. And how brave of you, and what made you do it? And, you know, he told me what had made him do it was that he had had a patient in the 80s who had basically told him while he was being kept alive on machines, breathing machines, that he wanted him to let him get off the machines. And the family said, no, keep him alive. And as this went on for a period of time, and this patient was very insistent, take me off these machines, Al Connors realized that he was really holding this man down against his will and making him live in an hospital bed, you know, on a ventilator in a facility. And, you know, ultimately he was going to be heading off to a facility. And he, after a lot of intervention with the family and talking and ethicists and chaplain support, the family finally said, we want to take him off the machine. And he died. But this case really stuck with Al Connors. And he, when the support trial came around, he said, I have to be one of those centers to study this issue because it's so important. We don't even think about people not wanting these things that we assume that they do. And I want to find out if this is really happening. And he found out in spades that, in fact, yes, we were over-medicalizing death, and our swan, our beloved swan, was in fact causing a tremendous amount of burden and suffering and death. And he really did have a very, not, I would say, frosty response from the pulmonary and critical care community, but not only that, but a hostile, actively hostile response. And his stories are in my book, which are quite fascinating.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jessica Nudick-Zitter. She is a critical care and palliative care physician in Oakland, California, also author of the brand new book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. And Jessica Zitter, you are featured in a documentary that is nominated for an Oscar in the short category called Extremis. I had a look at that documentary. It's wonderful. It shows you in action at Highland Hospital in Oakland. And really, it features, I would say, primarily two sort of cases that you're involved in. And you alluded to one earlier about the patient Donna, who has some kind of neuromuscular disease where she is clearly not strong enough at this point. The illness is advanced and she won't be able to simply breathe on her own. And so the loved one, I'm not sure if it's her spouse or her child, actually.
It's her brother.
Okay, her brother. Sorry. So her brother agrees to take out the tube and then, but she dies a more peaceful death. But 24 hours later, as you said, now there's another person featured. This is where a family has actually performed CPR on their own loved one. But unfortunately, in spite of their best efforts, I think this patient was quote-unquote down or not receiving, you know, not circulating blood effectively for something like 12 to 20 minutes, and that we know that that can cause permanent brain damage. And so she's surrounded by her brothers, but also has a daughter who seems to be the primary surrogate decision maker for that patient. And there's this bit of filmed dialogue between you and the daughter, and it just pained me personally. I mean, not anything against the daughter, but she said the kind of the stock quote that we hear so often in the medical world. I'm something to the effect of, I'm expecting miracles. Miracles do happen. Mm-hmm. And tell us what happened with that case.
That was a That was a tough case. It's hard sometimes for doctors, even though I say and I mean that I really care that people have the ability to choose what's right for them, and a lot of times their choices would be ones that I wouldn't make, or that would be very different from mine. I really believe that when someone is sort of informed and aware of the benefits and burdens of all the possible options that we have going forward, that it is their decision to make. And there are some cases where it's not what I would choose. And this was a tough one for me. I really spent a lot of time with their family, and I really wanted to give them the information. I was very concerned about, she'd had a very severe brain injury, and she wasn't going to be herself again, and I wanted them to understand that, and I did want them to understand, again, this is hard information to pass to people, but that what does it look like to be chronically tied to a breathing machine? And I spent a lot of time, again, explaining it. Just want to make sure you understand that the decubitus ulcers and arms tied down and being in a long-term acute care facility. These are hard things to say because you feel, you as a doctor, you could almost feel cruel saying this stuff. Why not just let her hope, and why not just let her, believe that there could be a miracle? Well, I don't know because I'm not God. I mean, can I say for sure that somehow there would be some kind of miraculous recovery? I would be so shocked I might even hang up my shingle, but I'm never going to say never because I'm not all-knowing and I don't have a crystal ball. But in my experience, someone like Selena, that patient, would really had no chance of recovering to any life that resembled her former life. And I wanted this family to understand that because I felt that, ultimately they may think that she wouldn't, want to live that way. But as we continued our conversations, the daughter really did seem to feel that that's what the patient wanted, and we honored that for sure. She went on to live, as it says in the movie, another several months, staying in the hospital, attached to machines, with a lot of medical complications, a lot. And then eventually died. And, I can't say for sure that that wasn't the right decision. I have absolutely no idea who this woman, Selena, was. What I do know is I was speaking to her daughter and not to her. And, you can only hope that shared, substituted decision-making, which is when someone, your loved one, is really making the decisions for you, is really the right approximation of what it is that you would want. And that is the danger with it, is you never know for sure. But that was a really tough case. It was a really tough case. And I think it was tough for her as well. And it's just tough for everyone involved.
Jessica Nudick-Sitter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jessica Zitter will be appearing tomorrow night as part of the Claire House Conversation Series, this time taking place at the Hard Rock Hotel. The event begins with a reception at 4:30, and the program will begin at 5:30. For more information, you can go to clairehouse.org or call 918-893-6150. This event is free and open to the public. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our interviews, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.